This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Today we're talking drones, not bees, unmanned aircraft. Drones are an addition to our everyday vocabulary, mostly hearing about military strikes and surveillance. But unmanned aerial vehicle technology is bringing UAVs into our everyday lives right here in Iowa. We'll be hearing from engineers and businessmen designing the aircraft and the work they'll be doing. And we'll hear concerns about privacy. Are you ready for drones? We'll hear more right after the NPR News. Dean Borg with River to River on Iowa Public Radio, and today we're going to be talking about unmanned aerial vehicles. And on the phone we have Rory Paul, who's with Volt Aerial Robotics. He's the CEO of Volt Aerial Robotics. And Mr. Paul?
Hi. Good afternoon. Hi.
Nice to have you on River to River.
Thank you for having me.
And Ben Stone is the executive director of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. Ben's been an Iowan for a long time. Ben, you were in our Des Moines studio.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you along with us. Mr. Paul, am I correct that aerial robotics specializes in agricultural UAVs?
We do. I've been working on agricultural UAVs since 2006, and our specialty is agriculture and environmental use of these systems.
And how did that develop? I mean, has that company been around a long time? And it seems to me that unmanned aerial vehicles are somewhat new. Is the company new, too?
The company is relatively new. I formalized the company last year, but basically my interest started really as a hobby. But it's always been focused on the agricultural applications of unmanned technology, which I kind of back in 2006 and 7 saw a huge potential for lowering the cost of aerial imagery for farmers using unmanned systems.
And has that been borne out? I mean, was that a good decision to form the company?
I believe so. I think that the timing was right. There's been a lot of interest in the last 18 months. The public are becoming more aware of it. Farmers are definitely becoming more aware of the possibilities of using these type of systems at various levels for various applications. So for me, it was we kind of coming to a point where public interest and the cost of technology has decreased. It's all kind of merging at the same point in time.
And you say farmers are becoming more aware. Maybe I'm being too precise here and too fine a point, but there's a difference between awareness and actually doing it.
Yes. Well, it starts off with awareness, but there are actually farmers out there that have been doing this since 2006, 2007, privately. Purchasing these systems and actually using them over their own land. Mm-hmm. And now with this general public awareness of the use of UAVs or drones, if you'd like to call them that, there's been this interest in what they can do for civilian users. And we're seeing instances where farmers are saving a lot of money using these systems.
Ben, he made a distinction there. He said drones, if you want to call them that. I know that you call them drones. Others like to call them unmanned aerial vehicles. Is there a distinction there, or is it just personal preference?
Well, I think that there's a preference that the industry likes to use, and then there's a preference that regular people like to use. Clearly, drones is an easier word, and people kind of know what it means, but the industry doesn't have drone in the name of its association, and so I think that's really the difference.
Well, is there sort of a negative connotation to drone?
Oh, probably. I think that would probably be borne out with focus group analysis, but it is what it is. It is a vehicle that can surveil people.
Sure.
In some instances, it can kill people. And, you know, Star Wars came first, so I guess that's the way it is.
We're bringing into the conversation now, we have on the line Tim Edelman, and he's with a company called Air Cover, and he's legal counsel for Air Cover. Welcome to the conversation, Mr. Aylin.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
What's the difference between an unmanned aerial vehicle and a remotely controlled airplane that I see someone flying over the open field?
Sure, and actually kind of pairing off the last comment on drone versus UAS versus remote control airplane, there are some significant differences in the terms that you use. Unmanned aircraft systems, it used to be unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs.
Yes.
The FAA redefined it as an unmanned aircraft system because the concept was that there's an entire system. There's both an aircraft in the air, and then there's a ground control system. And recently, it's been changed by a number of industry participants, FAA, the Department of Defense, and others, to remotely piloted vehicle, because the concept of a drone or an unmanned aircraft suggests that there's no one controlling it, that it's just out there, you know, randomly flying. And so now you see this term called RPV, remotely piloted vehicle, and that's probably the most accurate term would be remotely piloted vehicle system, and that describes the whole package. But in terms of what we call a UAS or a drone or RPV, whatever you want to use, versus a remote control airplane, it really gets down to the intended use of the aircraft. There's a website called Do It Yourself Drones, where you know any Joe Citizen can go out there and buy a remote-controlled helicopter or airplane or hovercraft and throw a camera on it, a GoPro camera, and have essentially the same technology that maybe a UAS would have, with you know a little less of the bells and whistles and safety systems in place. But because it's used as a hobby, it comes under the FAA's exception for hobbyist activities. But if you use it for commercial purposes, or if you use it for law enforcement purposes or fire and rescue, that takes it into a different category, and now the FAA defines that as an aircraft, and as an aircraft, you have to comply with all the FAA regulations.
Rory Paul or Ben Stone, you've heard the distinction here that attorney Tim Edelman with Air Cover has made. Any comments on what you've just heard?
I'm going to let Ben go first.
Go ahead, Ben. He's the executive director of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union.
Sure. Thanks, Dean. Well, you know, first of all, to get back to the agricultural use, you know, we certainly at the ACLU, we have absolutely no problems whatsoever with a farmer using this technology to help their own farm operation. And if that's something that the FAA is dragging its feet on, you know, that's certainly not something the ACLU is advocating for. The notion that there's the ability of people to acquire a drone, you know, through that website that was just mentioned, you know, that is rather startling when you think about it, how much things have changed, that people can actually, you know, there's always been, you know, for years there's been people that had those little airplanes, you know, little gas-powered airplanes, and they'd go out there in the big fields and they'd gas them up and they'd take off. And
yes.
You know, well, now you've got remote control, and of course my kids have had remote controlled air, you know, helicopters and stuff to play around in the house or in the yard, but obviously they're now, those little kids' toys are no longer the limit. There's these adult toys. And I think what's interesting is that people can literally operate these, you know, without any, you know, if they're like I said, if they're recreational, then it's fairly unregulated, but it's the commercial or the law enforcement. And certainly there should be a distinction. Now, if someone's abusing their recreational use by spying on their neighbor, trying to catch them in their backyard, then that would certainly not be appropriate. And that needs to be subject to some government sanction. But generally, you know, if people can use these things and invade other people's privacy, then there needs to be regulation. That's really all the ACLU is here to say is, you know, we've been saying for a couple of years now with our, we had a report in December of 2011 that really came out and said, look, we got this stuff's coming. There's some very interesting technology. It's got many good uses. We need to get in front of it with policy that will make sure that it doesn't overwhelm our lives and that we can maintain our autonomy and our freedom as Americans in public spaces while allowing the useful and practical purposes of this new technology to be used to make our lives better.
Now, what about that? First, Mr. Paul, and then I'll call on you, Tim Edelman, as an attorney, and Ben Stone is an attorney, too. But, Mr. Paul,
what you hear from
the ICLU, is that kind of put the clamps on you as an entrepreneur?
No, I kind of see this, and there's some nuances of law that are kind of being overlooked. We have the use of UAVs. Now, you can look at this from the privacy point of view, and I fully agree that we need to kind of define the legal parameters that these systems can be operated in. Now, we have another aspect to it, and this is something that is not being discussed, and that is the rights of private property. Let's say that you're an Iowa farmer and you wish to fly a UAV at 400 feet within line of sight, which the FAA says that you can do for recreation. But as soon as you start taking imagery and incorporate that into your farming practices, currently the FAA claims that you've actually broken the law. You're not allowed to use a UAV for commercial purposes. Now, my point is that over private property, we have air rights, or we should have air rights to a certain altitude. And it's that needs to be defined, because right now, an Iowa farmer can take out and fly a $50,000 jet-powered radio-controlled plane for recreation. But if he wants to fly a 6-pound foamy and take foam-based UAV and fly and actually take photographs, he's not permitted to do this, okay, by the FAA. And my personal opinion, and this is my opinion as a layman, that this is actually an infringement, okay, of his Fifth Amendment private property rights.
I'm going to pause before we bring Mr. Edelman in for another legal opinion here. He's with Air Cover, you recall. I'll give you the phone number for you who are listening to get involved. It's 866-780-9100. What about it? What about remotely piloted vehicles or unmanned aerial vehicles? Would you like to see them flying over Iowa fields? 866-780-9100. What about it, Tim Edelman?
Well, I think, you know, we got a couple topics on the table here. Ben had an interesting comment, and I think it's an important one, which is the concern of privacy. In the arena where you have commercial use, the farmer, the agriculture, the guy out there who's going to use this thing to survey his crops, to monitor fields, the crop conditions, to monitor hydration, et cetera, or for law enforcement or fire and rescue to use it for their daily missions, any one of those uses does come with it regulations that already exist, as well as case law and Fourth Amendment rights in terms of privacy. The area that has very little to no regulation at this point is the private citizen who goes out and does this on their own. So, but what we've seen a lot now in the past year or so is an increase of people crying out for regulations to stop the use of these by law enforcement, to stop the use by commercial providers, because they're going to be, you know, I think the term I always hear, spying on people. And that's just not the fact. The bigger concern is just an individual who goes out there and flies this over their neighbors. There's really very little at this stage that the police could do, or even that individual could do. Maybe they can go file an injunction to stop a nuisance, but there's very little you could do. However, if the police were to fly it over your backyard to look into your backyard to obtain, evidence without a warrant, that's actually prohibited by law currently on the books today. So I think as we go down this road.
Would you have the cite for that?
Sure.
Because I'm not familiar with
Kylo
that.
Kylo versus the United States was a United States Supreme Court decision that looked at the use of advanced technology, infrared technology, to look into a house. And what the court said is, if the government uses technology that is not generally available to the public, then that would be considered a search. And in this case, because UAS cannot be used by a private citizen at this stage because the FAA regulations, that it would be considered a technology not available to the public, and as such, a warrant would be needed.
Tim, I hear what you're saying, and Ben, thank you for that question of clarification there. And related here, we have Jerry calling in from Cedar Rapids. Jerry, go ahead, because what you want to ask is exactly what they're talking about.
Well, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm calling because as an investigator, I've had occasion to deal with cases where I know that there is what's known as a reasonable expectation of privacy. And I think the use of drones is something that we really have to address, because there may be the assumption that you can use these to investigate civil cases, worker compensation cases, where people have very simply erected fences in their yards, and they do have an expectation of privacy, something that we have respected for many, many years, but this gives the opportunity for anybody to use a device that would violate that privacy.
I'm going to ask Ben Stone. Thank you, Jerry. Just hold on the line. Mm-hmm. Let's let Ben Stone speak.
Yeah, well, you know, that case that that Tim referenced, you know, that I really hope they interpret that case the way you just did, Tim, but I think that's hopeful thinking. I think that the drone technology is new enough that the case law will eventually catch up, but we would like to see policy adopted in front of the technology's use so we can get the corrections on it. But so, yeah, it's a situation where technology goes faster than the law. And, yeah, individual people that go out and use a drone to spy on their neighbors, you could probably have a pretty good chance at a privacy tort where you'd be able to sue them for invading your privacy, but you'd have to be able to prove it. And we don't want to see the courts try to deal with this. This needs to be something that policymakers and lawmakers need to be able to do to, you know, thoughtfully think through what is the best use. Because, you know, some of these things are obviously, you know, there's a survey that Monmouth College did about a year ago that said that, you know what, for most purposes, for the purposes of like emergencies and finding lost children, the public's very supportive. But when it comes to the routine use by police, like putting a bunch of drones above the city to catch speeders, 2/3 were strongly opposed and only less than 1 out of 4 were in favor of that. So there's a lot of suspicion.
Craig and Jerry, thanks from Cedar Rapids. Thanks for calling in with that question. And Craig also is calling from Cedar Rapids with a related question. Go ahead, Craig.
What if a farmer has 1,000 acres and way beyond his own eyesight, he gets a call that he's being robbed of hay or cattle? So he sends a drone out there with a camera to find out the license plate number, identity, et cetera. Supposedly, that would be illegal by what is being said on this show.
What about that?
This is Rory Paul again.
Yes.
I think that it would be really a question of law. There's no law now that would speak to that. I think that you would be within your property rights to do that. Okay, because you have rights to actually fly over your own property for recreation. Mm-hmm. I think these questions haven't been answered yet. Okay,
We're hearing there from Roy Paul, who is the CEO of Volt Aerial Robotics, mm-hmm. Just outside St. Louis, Missouri. Tim Edelman, you want to weigh in on Craig's question?
Sure. To the extent that that farmer is using it not in a commercial capacity. And it's a fine line, and it is a gray line. There are no bright lines in this, but a commercial capacity would be if he's growing a wheat crop and he's using that UAS to help enable him to continue to grow that wheat crop and sell it, that's a commercial activity. If he's got it because someone's on his property and he wants to determine who it is and protect his property, I would not view that as a commercial activity. I'd use that as a personal activity, and as such, it would fall under the hobbyist category. So, and again, this is a part that the FAA has really struggled with, is where do we define this line of, you know, just the average citizen out there flying this thing for fun or for their own personal experience or even their own scientific experiment that they want to create on this aircraft versus commercial. At some point, it does transition to commercial. That line will be gray and slowly transition into that.
Tim Edelman, you've just spoken, and I am trying to identify voices here. You're with AirCover, and you have an operator performance lab located in Cedar Rapids. I'd ask you this question. You know, people are we're talking legal aspects here, but how prevalent are what we'll call drones or remotely piloted vehicles or aerial unmanned vehicles? How prevalent are they right now over the Iowa landscape?
Well, let me back up for 1 second. I am an attorney that specializes in unmanned aircraft law. I don't work I'm not employed by AirCover. I just work with them on certain projects. So I just want to make it clear that – and I also work with other industry participants, law enforcement, et cetera. I think there is – and this is actually a good segue back sort of to Ben's question or reference to the Mammoth research study. Right now, the FAA has pretty strict restrictions on where you can fly a UAS. You cannot fly a UAS over a city for persistent surveillance right now. Not allowed, even when you get a certificate of authorization. So this concept that we're going to have aircraft up in the air constantly monitoring is not reality. Aircraft like the one that AirCarver produces have about anywhere from a 20 to 30 minute duration in flight. They're really good at going up and giving you situational awareness and taking quick pictures. The hurdle that we have right now is that there's a lack of FAA regulations for commercial use of these things, and therefore there are not many of them out there being used by farmers in Iowa at this state. There may be some that they've a handful of them, but it's not as prevalent. The big push now is to say this is a technology that is extremely useful to the agricultural industry. It provides them very low-cost, eyes-in-the-sky view of their crops for proper management of agriculture. And the goal now is to see if we can't push the FAA forward on the civil use rules to allow these things to be used by farmers and such.
And when you say push, you're insinuating there that the FAA needs a push, that they're somehow impeding development of remotely piloted vehicles.
No, the FAA is not impeding development. The FAA has an advisory rule committee that was created a couple of years ago that drafted a rule for civil use. That rule was then submitted to the FAA to be considered and published, and it should be coming out this year, hopefully. They keep pushing it out, pushing out the date to publish this rule. Really, one of the things that's come up recently is this, what I call the privacy scare, which is kind of clamped down the FAA moving forward because somehow privacy has become an FAA concern. In reality, it should be a DOJ concern. The FAA is not an expert in privacy. They don't do privacy. Their regulations should not in any way integrate privacy into their actions, but maybe the DOJ or some other state legislature should consider if they want to put regulations out there for privacy. So what's happening now is the FAA is struggling with pushing out the civil rule, partly because of the clampdown and trying to figure out whose role it is on the privacy side.
We're coming up to a break here just in a minute, but Tim Edelman's going to be leaving us after that break. Tim, is there something that you want to say that we haven't at all touched on before we have to say goodbye to you?
The only thing I would say is that as we look at the use of unmanned aircraft system, we should really look at the practical and the real the use and reality of these aircraft. And what I mean by that is these aircraft, as I said earlier, are situational awareness aircraft. For law enforcement, their best use is really forensics. You have a car accident, you want to take a picture of the scene before you have to clear the accident. They're great for that. If you want to search for stolen property on state parks, they're great for that. Search and rescue, they're great for that.
Are they being used for that now?
Yes. They are not good for patrol.
Uh-huh. Tim, thanks so much for your comments. We're, as I said, going to be saying goodbye to you now, and thanks for spending time with us. Tim is legal counsel for AirCover, and that has an operation in Cedar Rapids. Rory Paul and Ben Stone will be back in our next segment along with other guests. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dean Borg, River to River on Iowa Public Radio. We're speaking about the expanding use of unmanned aerial vehicles. Some might call them drones or remotely piloted vehicles. We've had all three terms here during the first half hour. In the first part of the program, we were speaking with the developers of technology and with some providing cautionary comments. We'll be bringing the CEO of Volt Aerial Robotics, that's Rory Paul, and Iowa Civil Liberties Executive Director Ben Stone back into our conversation in just a moment. But first, let's hear from an Iowa State University professor who is developing sensors to make UAVs more effective. He's Atul Kelkar, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering. Professor Kelkar, what are these sensors?
So these sensors, just to to be technically accurate, are not new to the industry per se. These are the static pressure sensors which can be deployed on the surface of the aircraft.
Are they something that's new? I mean, have drones been around a long time and now you're designing sensors to make them even more effective?
That's correct. The use of these sensors would be more widespread than just drones. If they are proven to work effectively on these drones, then they can be also deployed on actually commercial aviation, civil aviation platforms as well as the other military platforms.
What does it enable those aircraft to do that they weren't able to do before you designed the sensors?
Okay, these sensors sense the air pressure distribution around the aircraft or around any air vehicle. It could be basically UAV, or drone is being used as a, it's kind of a lexicon now because it has been used in a military setting first. But these sensors will give you, so what we used to call, like to call is a pressure signature of that particular vehicle at any point of the time in the flight. And these sensors, they give you instantaneous condition of the aircraft health.
Well, but why is that important? Why do you want to know that the air pressure is?
Yeah, because the whole mechanics of flying of these air vehicles is based on this pressure. But currently, there is no sensing mechanism that exists in these air vehicles. The only sensors that are used in control of the vehicles are the motion sensors.
Uh-huh. Are they transmitting data to a computer on board the aircraft, or are they transmitting data to someone somewhere in the world controlling that drone?
Okay, excellent question, Dean. Actually, these sensors, the way we anticipate these sensors when they are proven on the prototype system, they will be transmitting data to the vehicle's onboard control system for its own monitoring, as well as they will be transmitting data to the ground control, because that will enable the other aircraft in the vicinity or the other UAVs in the vicinity to know the proximity of these vehicles to each other, because many times some missions will require them flying in a group, like they call formation flying.
Mm-hmm. So does it make the drone have greater applications, like to agriculture or surveillance, to have this extra enhanced data available?
Yeah, this extra enhanced data will do two things. One is it will increase the performance of these drones or UAVs when they are used in a precision agriculture application, because they will be able to actually fly in their flight envelope will be much more expanded, so they can reach to the areas or regions where currently they cannot do because of the lack of sophisticated sensor technology.
Mm-hmm. Is that particularly important, say, in mountainous areas where air pressure would be different than it is, say, in Iowa, or would it be different over in different temperatures, such as over the Arctic, that it is over Iowa? Or what do these sensors enable that aircraft to do? Am I getting to the real purpose of them?
Yes, you are. But all of those areas that you just mentioned, these sensors will be useful in all of those conditions. In the mountain areas, of course, there are a lot of air currents and the pressures are changing, and you need that instantaneous information so that you can avoid any aerodynamic anomaly that can cause your vehicle to fail or vehicle to lose the trajectory or take a dive into the to crash the vehicle. Same as in Iowa, although we don't have mountains, we still have a continuously changing weather pattern or air currents. And that also is important for these vehicles to keep them on track.
Would this, just supposing here, might this also be taken up then into a storm or before a storm occurs, that you wouldn't use a manned aircraft, but you could use a drone up to do some surveillance of the approaching storm?
Yes, exactly. So whenever there is a hazard to human life or likelihood of getting human life in danger, you can use, you are going to use these UAVs or drones for those conditions, and these sensors will help sustain flights of these UAVs without causing them to crash.
Thank you, Professor Kelkar. And that was Iowa State University Mechanical Engineering Professor Atul Kelkar. He was on Iowa Public Radio's AIM studio on the Iowa State University campus. And now continuing our conversation with Volt Aerial Robotics CEO Rory Paul, who heads a company in Chesterfield, Missouri, that's just outside St. Louis, and also Iowa Civil Liberties Union Executive Director Ben Stone, and he's in our Des Moines studios. And we're inviting in University of Iowa Professor Tom Schnell. He's in the UI Center for Computer-Aided Design. He researches how to avoid human error by those operating unmanned aerial vehicles. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, Dean.
I wanted to go back to Rory Paul, and he is with Volt Aerial Robotics. He's the CEO there. Anything that you heard in our interview the professor at Iowa State?
I did, because we have really a practical, real-world example of where sensor technology needs to improve. We fly a rotary wing quadcopter system that uses current air pressure sensors to basically hold altitude. And we've noticed that as the wind actually increases, this affects the ability of the UAV to maintain an accurate altitude. So what we do is we kind of use a combination of GPS data fused with the sensor data to try and even that out. So improvements there, are really critical to actually flying a UAV accurately.
And I would like to ask our ICLU Executive Officer Ben Stone, are you, as I am, Ben, are you surprised by the pervasiveness already of unmanned aerial vehicles in Iowa?
Well, I guess, within the agricultural world, since I haven't been, keeping up on the latest in that area, it didn't surprise me when I read the story last summer that the Department of Agriculture was using drone technology to do some of the things that the Department of Agriculture does with the farmers that participate in various programs and environmental regulations, things like that. But it has really been, frankly, quite interesting to learn many of the ways that our really smart people in this world really make really, really cool things that are really useful. But at the same time, there's some really potentially very scary things about this technology that, just think 20 or 30 years down the road. What is possible? What's happened in the last 5 years? Extrapolate that another generation or two.
Well, are you saying UAV? Are you seeing these UAVs as new servants, allowing our society to more efficiently perform work? Or, you used the word scary just a minute ago here, is a UAV a threat?
Well, I think the threat is really that there's an industry, and a lot of it's tied with the aerospace and defense industries. They want these everywhere. That's how they're going to make money. They want to sell as many as possible. They're lobbying Congress. They're getting Congress to push out grant money so local law enforcement will buy these. And so there's a tremendous economic incentive system operating within our government that is pushing this. This isn't just, is this a good idea? No, there are people paid a lot of money that have a lot of money that are trying to make sure that the skies of America are filled with drones someday so that they can make more profits.
But that's exactly what Rory Paul, who is on the line here, he's CEO, I remind you, of Volt Aerial Robotics in Chesterfield, Missouri. That's exactly what he wants to do, don't you, Mr. Paul? You want to sell UAVs.
I want to sell UAVs, and because the potential benefit to American agriculture, in my personal opinion, if we can save 1% on inputs and increase yields by 1%, and we can expand that across the agricultural sector, we are talking about savings, and profits of billions of dollars. And the benefit to the environment. If we can reduce pesticide use or herbicide use by spot application in these systems, the benefits, in my personal opinion, outweigh the risks. Okay. Yes, there are going to be abuse of these systems, and there have been abuse of unmanned aerial vehicles already. And we have to legislate. But if we wait, our technological lead, a lot of these systems have been developed in America, and we're seeing the benefits in developing nations where the technology is being used already because they don't have the restrictive legislative policies in place.
Do you have more buyers in the United States than you do internationally?
I wouldn't say that. I have more interest in the developing world where they can see, I have an example of a team in Uruguay, not flying one of my systems, unfortunately, flying a large military-grade UAV that they're mapping thousands of acres a day, okay, for Uruguayan farmers, mm-hmm. okay, at a fraction of the cost that they could do this with a manned aircraft.
And is that because, do you not see the same thing in the United States because we aren't advanced? We have more restrictions. Now, I don't want to say we are more advanced, but we aren't as advanced in how we're regulating these aircraft?
Basically, what's happened is that, and this has been said, the policy has lagged the technology. 5 years ago, this didn't really exist. It was the realm of hobbyists and people with deep pockets. And a website was mentioned. It's called DIY Drones. There's now a push for open-source autopilot systems. A system that would have cost you $10,000 5 years ago, if you're good with a soldering iron, you can put it together for under $1,000 today. And a farmer can go out. These are technologies that farmers, for example, they're aware of them. GPS, computer systems, IMUs. Farmers are starting to come in contact with this. We're just packaging them in a different way.
Can a farmer afford a UAV?
Oh, definitely. If a farmer has any inclination and is prepared to develop the skills today, he can go online, and there are a number of sources where he can purchase an autopilot from, build an airframe, and go and be flying basically a UAV with the same capabilities as a military system. Okay, that's how far the technology is along.
But what would be his investment?
His investment, depending how much work he's prepared to do himself, could be as little as $1,000.
Oh. If you are intrigued by this conversation and learning as much as I am, I'd like to have you join the conversation if you have a question for our guests. 866-780-9100. That's River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Bringing Tom Schnell now into the conversation. He, remind you, is the University of Iowa Associate Professor, directing the Computer Assisted Design Operator Performance Laboratory. A lot of words there. But you are dealing with research, even in the human aspect, aren't you, Professor Schnell?
Correct. Primarily in the human aspects. The Operator Performance Laboratory is actually a flight research lab down at the Iowa City Airport. We have multiple aircraft. We have two jets, a helicopter. We have a fixed-wing piston aircraft and multiple flight simulators with which we study how humans operate with complex systems. Unmanned aerial or unmanned aircraft systems are emerging now as a new tool. And while with manned aircraft, we have very clear guidelines how you certify a pilot, and you go through a flight instructional regimen of training. You have to pass certain tests, written tests, practical test standards. Once you're done with that, you're a certified pilot. Currently, it's not very clear how that process would work out.
Well, you just heard Rory Paul say for $1,000, if I'm a farmer, for $1,000, I don't even have to be a farmer. I can go out. Am I right, Rory? I can go out and buy a UAV myself?
Basically, essentially, your radio-controlled airplane with an autopilot in it becomes a UAV.
Tom Schnell, am I ready to fly one psychologically?
Absolutely. I've done it all my life as a model airplane guy. I think I was 12 years old when I started doing it, and you get good at it. Now, there's obviously bigger unmanned aerial systems that are more like full-sized aircraft that are thousands of pounds, and so maybe the standards will be higher for those type of systems that may also go on cross-country flights across thousands of miles, as opposed to just being local in one area.
What intrigues me, though, and I think some of your research involves this, how is it different for a UAV operator to, with my brain, cognitively process information that I really am not observing with my eye. I'm just looking at it on a screen. Is there a difference in how I react with what I do with what I'm seeing?
It definitely is. And there's also a detachment in the fact that you're not in the vehicle. So in an airplane, and I fly a lot, you get into weather, you can actually feel the effects of your decisions right away on your own airframe. You hear the rain on the windshield and all that. That's sensory input that allows you to make decisions. Maybe if the weather turns too bad, you turn back because it sounds pretty bad around you. You may lack that sensory effect when you fly a UAV, and you might make different decisions.
But would I also make different decisions just in being a human being and how I react to a possible, I don't want to say target, but I can do some bad things with UAV?
If you look at it, how it would operate in airspace, for example, a normal airplane needs to see and avoid. That could be birds. It could be non-cooperative traffic that don't even talk on the radio. Many listeners may not know. You can fly airplanes in U.S. airspace and never transmit a word on the radio. Airliners and other aircraft may have to be able to see and avoid using, obviously, air traffic control as a help. Imagine you're an operator of a UAV. You need the same capability from your ground station within the box that you sit in and operate that vehicle. You need to be able to see and avoid obstacles and objects, including other traffic.
Rory Paul, is the technology such in the aircraft, the unmanned aerial vehicles that you're selling right now, such as I can buy a motor vehicle that tells me that when I'm backing up and something I can't see, but there's a child or maybe a garbage can behind me, it will warn me. Do the unmanned aerial vehicles have that kind of technology that they know that they're near something else that they could crash into?
Dean, unfortunately not. Sense and avoid in the systems that I'm selling, and these are really small unmanned aerial vehicles, no, it doesn't exist at this moment in time. But that said, they're not intended for use in the same airspace as other aircraft. These are intended for use in visual line of sight only.
Ben?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, was that you interrupting?
No.
Oh, that was okay. Me. Okay. Tom, smaller UAS, as Rory's, they're like birds. You know, in other words, there's a lot of unmanned vehicles out there. They're called birds. They have their own minds. They go places, and we still have to see and avoid them as fixed-wing or rotary craft pilots. And the system works on that basis for sure. And there are places in the U.S. where you can, in fact, collaboratively fly with UAVs, for example, down at Fort Huachuca in Arizona. I have flown aircraft in the same pattern with unmanned aerial vehicles, and you deconflict, basically using the same rules.
Rory Paul, this brings up a question in my mind. You're in agricultural applications for UAVs. Would they be used more for farming in wide open spaces like Nebraska and Montana, or they can be safely used, can they, in more heavily populated areas such as Iowa and even more densely California and Florida?
I believe that, well, the systems that I'm primarily interested in can be operated safely in areas like Iowa. As long as we can see the aircraft from the ground, we can cover approximately 600 acres in a flight. That means that we take the aircraft off, we stand in the middle of the field, we can observe the aircraft both from the ground control station, from the telemetry, and we also have on the ground observers that make sure that they can see the aircraft at all times. And we've had instances where we've had to avoid police helicopters, and it was a matter of landing the aircraft. So I think that these systems can be successfully operated without interfering with manned aircraft.
Ben, I'm going to bring you in just a minute to give us a closing thought on all that you've heard here as it relates to you being executive director of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. But I want to go back to Rory Paul and ask, you know, where do these aircraft take off from and where do they recover?
It depends on the system. So normally fixed-wing systems, you need a little bit more space to take off and recover. Normally a dirt road will be great in a between cornfields. The rotary wing systems, I mean, you could take those off from the bed of a pickup truck and bring them back in again.
Ben Stone?
Yeah, Dean. You know, there's been over 30 different states that have had bills introduced this session, this year, dealing with drones, with varieties. The one that was introduced here in Iowa is just calling for a moratorium. It didn't start the funnel, but what we're asking, what the ACLU is asking, and what a lot of people are asking around the country is that we need to slow down and we need to examine the proper role of drones in our lives mm-hmm. in this century. And if we don't, they're going to overwhelm us. So people need to contact their legislators, their policymakers, and let them know that the skies above America need to be ours and not the industry's.
Ben Stone is with the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. He's the CEO there. We've been talking with Rory Paul. He's CEO of Volt Aerial Robotics from Chesterfield, Missouri. And we've also been speaking with Tom Schnell at the University of Iowa, who directs the Computer Assisted Operator Performance Lab. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Statton. Executive producer, Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. I'm Dean Borg. River to River is produced by Iowa Public Radio.